After a king's wife, and a king's son, the metal workers would now have the most prestige in the new kingdom. Where is Xocol Haman? Where is the master shipbuilder? A strong man with massive shoulders emerged from another clan, smiling in pride and slapping his shoulders in piety. Take out the neck spine, Xocol Haman. You who are named for a great river in flood, you must tell me, have you ever seen this metal before? Xocol Haman fingered the bronze, getting blood all over his fingers. It looks like copper, only brighter, he said. I've never seen it. Bakab looked at it, too, and also shook his head. Pee on this metal, Xocol Haman. Make the current of the ocean within you flow upon it, for you will not paint my blood on your body until you have found this metal in another land. You will build ships, and you will sail them until you find the land in the north where they know the name of this metal. When you bring back the name of this metal to me, then you will paint my blood upon your groin. Only the iron spine remained. Where is Xoc? Yes, I mean the slave girl, the ugly girl you captured and no one would marry her. She was thrust forward, a filthy 13-year-old with a hare lip. Take out the last spine, Xoc. Paint my blood upon your feet. For by the power of this last metal will the king of Xibalba make all slaves free. Today you are a free citizen of the kingdom of Xibalba on earth, Xoc. You belong to no man or woman, for no man or woman belongs to any other. The king of Xibalba commands it. There are no captives, no slaves, no servants for life in the kingdom of Xibalba on earth. For you, Tagiri. But what he had given in pity was used in power. Xoc drew the iron spine from his penis, and then, just as a Maya queen would have done, she stuck out her tongue, gripped the tip of it with her left hand, and with her right hand drove the spine through it. Blood flooded down her chin as the spine in her lips made a strange cross. The people gasped. What Xoc was demanding was not the kindness of a lord toward a slave he plans to free, but the honor of a king for the queen who will bear his children. What do I do with this? Who could have guessed, watching Xoc's abject servility during her months of slavery, that she had this kind of ambition? What did she mean to accomplish? Hunapu studied her face and saw in it. What, defiance? It was as if she saw through his whole charade and dared him to refuse her. But no, it was not defiance. It was bravery in the face of fear. Of course she acted boldly. This kingly man who claimed to come from the land of the gods was the first chance she had to rise above her miserable condition. Who could blame her for acting as desperate people so often do, seizing on the first opportunity to reach far beyond all reasonable hope? What did she have to lose? In her despair, all salvation had seemed equally impossible. So why not try to be queen, as long as this one Hunapu seemed disposed to help her? She is so ugly, but smart and brave. Why close a door? He reached down and drew the iron spine from her tongue. Let truth flow from your mouth forever as blood does now. I am no king, and so I have no queen. But because you mixed your blood with mine upon this last spine, I promise that for the rest of your life I will listen every day to one thing that you choose to tell me. Gravely she nodded, her face showing relief and pride. He had turned away her bid to be a consort, but had accepted her as a counselor. And as he knelt and painted her feet with the bloody spine, she could not help but know that her life had been changed completely and forever. He had made her great in the eyes of those who had mistreated her. As he rose to his feet, he put both hands on her shoulders and leaned close so he could whisper in her ear. Do not seek vengeance now that you have power, he said in pure Maya, knowing that her native dialect was close enough that she would understand him well enough. Earn my respect by your generosity and truthfulness. Thank you, she answered. Now back to the original script, I hope, thought Hunapu, that there aren't too many more surprises like this. But, of course, there would be. All he could ever do was improvise. His plans would all have to be adapted, only his purposes were unchangeable. He flung out his voice over the crowd. Let Bakab touch this metal. Let Xocal Haman see it. The men came forward, studied it in awe. Alone of all the spines, it would not bend, not even slightly.
I have never seen a metal so strong, said Bakab.
Black, said Xocal Haman.
There are many kingdoms far across the sea where this metal is as common as copper is here. They will know how to smelt it until it shines white as silver. These kingdoms already know the king of Xibalba, for he has hidden many secrets from them. It is the will of the king of Xibalba that the kingdom of Xibalba on earth find this metal and master it, if you are worthy of it. But for now this black metal spine will stay with Xoc, who once was a slave, and you will come to her or to her children in order to see if you have found the hard black metal. The faraway people call it pharaoh, and harrow, and iron, and fair, but you will call it Xibix, for it comes from Xibalba, and must only be used in the service of the king.
The last of the spines was out of his body now. It made him feel pleasantly light, as if the weight of them had dragged him down.
Let this now be a sign to all of you, that the king of Xibalba touches all men and women of the world. This village will be struck with a plague, but not one of you will die of it. That promise had a chance of failure. The immunologist said that 1 in 100,000 would die of it. If one of those bad reactions came in Atatulka, Hunapu would deal with it well enough, and compared to the millions who died of smallpox and other diseases in the old history, it was a small price to pay.
The plague will go forth from this village to every land, until all people have been touched by the finger of the king. And they will all say, from Atatulka came the sickness of the lords of Xibalba. It came first to you because I came first to you, because the king of Xibalba chose you to lead the world, not as the Mexica lead in blood and cruelty, but as the king of Xibalba leads in wisdom and strength.
Might as well make the immunity virus part of the divinity show.
He looked around at their faces, awe and surprise, and here and there resentment. Well, that was to be expected. The power structure in this village was going to be transformed many times over before this was finished. Somehow these people would become leaders of a great empire. Only a few of them would be up to the challenge. Many would be left behind because they were suited only to the life of a village. There was no dishonor in that, but some would feel left out and hurt. Hunapu would try to teach them to be content with what was possible to them, teach them to take pride in the achievements of others. But he could not change human nature. Some of them would go to their graves, hating him for the changes that he brought. And he could never tell them how their lives might have ended, had he not interfered.
"Where will one Hunapu live?" he asked.
"In my house," cried Nayaxhal at once.
"Will I take the house of the king of Atatulka, when he is only now becoming a man? It has been the house of dogmen and women. No, you must build me a new house, here, on this very spot."
Hunapu sat down cross-legged in the grass.
"I will not move from this place until I have a new house around me. And over me, I will have a roof thatched from the roofs of all the houses of Atatulka. Now, Yaxhal, prove to me that you are a king. Organize your people to build me my house before darkness comes, and teach them their duties well enough that those who build it can do it without speaking a word."
It was already midday, but impossible as the task might look to the people, Hunapu knew that it was well within their capacity to do it. The story of the building of one Hunapu's house would spread, and it would make others believe that they were indeed worthy to be the greatest city among the cities of the new kingdom of Xibalba on earth. Such stories were needed in forging a new nation with a will to empire. The people had to have an unshakable belief in their own worthiness. And if they didn't make it before nightfall, Hunapu would simply fire up the basket of light and declare that the lords of Xibalba were lengthening the day with this piece of sunlight, so they could finish building the house before nightfall. Either way, the story would be a good one. The people quickly left him alone as Nayaxhal organized them to build him a house. Able to relax at last, Hunapu got the disinfectant out of one of his bags and applied it to his wounded penis. It contained agents to promote clotting and healing, and soon the flow of blood would become mere seepage and then stop.
Hunapu's hands trembled as he applied the salve, not from pain, for that had not yet begun, nor even from loss of blood, but rather from relief after the tension of the ceremonies just passed. In retrospect, it had been as easy to overawe these people as he had imagined it would be back when he had proposed his plan to the others in the lost future. Easy, but Hunapu had never been so frightened in his life. How did Columbus manage it, boldly creating a future? Only because he knew so little of how futures could go wrong, Hunapu decided. Only because of ignorance could he shape the world so fearlessly.
It's hard to imagine that these are the great kingdoms of the East that we read about in Marco Polo's account, said Sanchez. Cristoforo could hardly argue with him. Colba seemed vast enough to be the mainland of Asia, but the Indians insisted that it was an island, and that another island to the southeast, called Haiti, was much richer and had far more gold. Could that be Sipangu? Possibly. But it was discouraging to have to keep assuring the sailors, and above all the royal functionaries, that untold wealth was just a few more days sailing away. When would God allow him the moment of triumph? When would all the promises of gold and great kingdoms be obviously, clearly fulfilled so that he could return to Spain as viceroy and admiral of the ocean sea? What does that matter? Said Don Pedro. The greatest wealth of this place is before you in plain sight. What do you mean? Asked Sanchez. The only thing this land is wealthy in is trees and insects. And people, said Don Pedro. The gentlest, most peaceful people I've ever seen. It will be no trouble at all to get them to work, and they'll obey their masters perfectly. There's no fight in them at all, can't you see that? Can't you imagine what price they would fetch as the most docile of servants? Cristoforo frowned. That same thought had occurred to him, but it troubled him all the same. Was it what the Lord had had in mind, to convert them and enslave them at the same time? Yet there was no other source of wealth in sight, here in the land that God had led him to. And it was obvious that these savages were completely unfit to be made into soldiers in a crusade. If God had meant these savages to be free Christians, he would have taught them to wear clothing instead of going about naked. Of course, said Cristoforo. We will bring a sample of these people back to their majesties when we return. But I imagine that it will be more profitable to keep them here in the land they're acclimated to, and use them to mine gold and other precious metals while we teach them of Christ and see to their salvation. The others heard him without disagreement. How could they argue with something so obviously true? Besides, they were still weak and weary from the illness that had swept through the crews of all three ships, obliging them to drop anchor and rest for several days. No one died from it. It was nowhere near as virulent as the terrible plagues that the Portuguese had run into in Africa, forcing them to build their forts on offshore islands. But it had left Cristoforo with quite a headache, and he was sure the others suffered from it too. If it didn't hurt so much, he might wish for it to continue forever, since it kept them from raising their voices. The royal functionaries were much more tolerable when pain kept them from becoming strident. They had been livid back when they reached the city called Cubanacan. Cristoforo had thought that the last syllable of the name referred to the great Khan of Marco Polo's writing, but when they reached the city the natives had babbled about, it turned out to be a miserable collection of huts, perhaps a bit more populated than the other squalid villages that they had seen on this island. City of the Khan, indeed. Sanchez had dared to raise his voice then in front of the men. Maybe this minor plague was God's remonstrance against his insubordinate complaining. Maybe God wanted to give him something to whine about. Tomorrow or the next day they would sail for Haiti. Perhaps there they would see some sign of the great civilizations of Sipangu or Cathay. And in the meantime, these miserable islands would at least be a source of slaves. And as long as the royal functionaries were willing to back him up, that might be enough to justify the cost of a second voyage, should they fail to find the Khan himself on this first trip.
Kamau sat glumly on the crest of the promontory, looking out to the northwest for a sail. Columbus was late. And if he was late, all bets were off. It meant that some change had already been introduced, something that would delay him in Kolba. Kamau might have been encouraged to think of this as proof that one of the others had successfully made the trip into the past, except that he was quite aware that the change might have been caused by him. The only influence that could reach from the island of Haiti to the island of Kolba was the carrier virus, and even though he'd only been here for 2 months, that was plenty of time for the virus to have been spread to Kolba by a raiding party in a sea-going canoe. The Spaniards must have contracted the virus. Or worse, the gentle plague might have caused a change in behavior by the Indies. There might have been bloodshed, bad enough to make the Europeans head for home. Or Columbus might have been told something that led him to take a different route, circling Haiti counterclockwise, for instance, instead of charting the north shore. They had known that the virus could upset their plans because it would move faster and farther than the time travelers could. Yet it was also the surest, most basic aspect of their plan. What if only one traveller got through, and then was killed immediately? Even so, the virus would be communicated to those who touched the body during the first few hours. If no other change could be introduced, this one might be enough to keep the Indies from being swept away in the tide of European diseases. "So it's a good thing," Kamau told himself. "A good thing that Columbus is late, because it means that the virus is doing its work. We've already changed the world. We've already succeeded." Only it didn't feel like success to him. Living on stored rations, hiding out here on this isolated promontory, watching for the sails, Kamau wanted to accomplish something more personal than being the carrier of a healing virus. Allah wills whatever happens, he knew, but he was not so pious that he could keep himself from wishing he could whisper a word or two in Allah's ear, a few pointed suggestions. It wasn't until the third day that he saw a sail, too early in the day. In the old version of history, Columbus had arrived later, which was why the Santa Maria wrecked, running against a submerged reef in the darkness. Now it wouldn't be dark. And even if it were, the currents and winds would not be the same. Kamau would have to destroy all three ships. Worse, without the accident with the Santa Maria, there would be no reason for the Niña to drop anchor. Kamau would have to follow along the shore and watch for his opportunity, if it came. "If I fail," thought Kamau, "the others may still succeed. If Hunapu manages to preempt the Tlaxcalans and create a Zapotec Tarascan Empire that has abandoned or downplayed human sacrifice, then the Spanish won't have such an easy time of it. If Dico is somewhere in the highlands, she may be able to create a new proto-Christian religion, and conceivably a unified Caribbean empire that the Spaniards will not easily crack. After all, Spanish success depended almost entirely upon the inability of the Indies to organize serious resistance. So even if Columbus gets back to Europe, history will still be different. He could whisper all these reassuring things, but they tasted like ashes in his mouth. "If I fail, America loses its 50 years of preparation before the Europeans come." Two ships, not three. That was a relief. Or was it? As long as history was changing, it might have been better for Columbus's fleet to stay together. Pinzon had taken the Pinta away from the rest of the fleet, just as in the former history. But now who could guess whether Pinzon would have his change of heart and sail back to Haiti to rejoin Columbus? This time he might simply go on eastward, arriving in Spain first and claiming all the credit for Columbus's discovery. "That's out of my hands," Kamau told himself. "The Pinta will either come back or it will not. I have the Niña and the Santa Maria, and I must make sure that they at least never return to Spain." Kamau watched until he could see that the ships were turning south to round the Cape of San Nicolas. Would they take the same course they had followed in the prior history, sailing south a bit more, then turning back to chart the north coast of the island of Haiti? Nothing was predictable anymore. Even if logic proclaimed that whatever reasons Columbus had for his actions in the other history, The same reasons would hold sway this time, too. Kamal picked his way carefully down to the stand of trees near the water where he had concealed his inflatable boat. Unlike lifeboats, this one was not bright orange. Rather, it was a greenish-blue, designed to be invisible on the water. Kamal pulled on his wetsuit, also greenish-blue, and pulled the boat into the water. Then he loaded it with enough underwater charges to deal with both the Santa Maria and the Niña, should the opportunity present itself. Then he started up the engine and put out to sea. It took him a half hour to be far enough from shore to be reasonably confident of being invisible to the keen-eyed watchers on the Spanish caravels. Only then did he sail westward far enough to see the Spanish sails. To his relief, they had dropped anchor off Cape San Nicolas, and small boats were putting to shore. It might be December 9th rather than the 6th, but Columbus was making the same decisions he had made before. The weather was getting cold for this part of the world, and Columbus would have the same problems getting through the channel between Tortuga and Haiti until the 14th of December. Perhaps Kamal would be better off if he put back to shore and waited for history to repeat itself. Or perhaps not. Columbus would be anxious to sail east in order to beat Pinzon back to Spain, and this time he might go out around Tortuga, tacking into the trade winds and completely avoiding the treacherous shore winds that would drive him onto the reefs. This might be Kamal's last chance. But then Cape San Nicolas was far from where Diko's tribe lived, if in fact she had succeeded in becoming part of the village that had first called to the people of the future to save them. Why make things harder for her? He would wait and watch.
At first, when the Pinta started slipping farther and farther away, Cristoforo supposed that Pinzon was avoiding some hazard in the water. Then, as the caravel drifted nearer the horizon, Cristoforo tried to believe what the men were telling him, that the Pinta must be unable to read the signals that Cristoforo was sending. This was nonsense, of course. The Niña also lay to port side and was having no trouble at all staying on course. By the time the Pinta dropped over the horizon, Cristoforo knew that Pinzon had betrayed him, that the one-time pirate was now determined to sail direct for Spain and report to their majesties before Cristoforo could get there. Never mind that it would be Cristoforo who was recognized officially as the head of the expedition, or that the royal officials traveling with the expedition would report Pinzon's perfidy. It would be Pinzon who would reap the first fame, Pinzon, whose name would live through history as the man who returned first to Europe from the westward route to the Orient. Pinzon had never sailed far enough south to know that steady east wind gave way in lower latitudes to the steady west wind that Cristoforo had felt when he sailed in Portuguese vessels. So there was a good chance that if Cristoforo could just get far enough south, he could reach Spain long before Pinzon, who would no doubt be tacking his way across the Atlantic, a slow proposition at best. There was a good chance that Pinzon's progress would be so slow that he would have to give up and return to these islands to resupply his caravel. A good chance, but no certainty. And Cristoforo could not shake the sense of urgency and barely suppressed fury that Pinzon's disloyalty had provoked. Worst of all, there was no one in whom he could confide, for the men were doubtless all rooting for Pinzon to win. While in front of the officers and the royal officials, Cristoforo could show no weakness or worry. So it was that Cristoforo took little pleasure in charting the unknown coast of the great island the natives called Haiti, and which Cristoforo had named Hispaniola. Perhaps he might have enjoyed the charting more if it had proceeded steadily, but the steady east wind was against him all along the coast. They had to harbor for days at the place that the men called Mosquito Bay, and again for several days at Paradise Valley. The men had made much of these stops, for the people here were taller and healthier, and two of the women light enough of skin that they were nicknamed the Spaniards by the men. As a Christian commander, Cristoforo had to pretend not to know what else was going on between the sailors and the women who came out to the caravels. Some of the tension of the voyage eased at Paradise Valley. But not for Cristoforo, who counted every day's delay as that much better a chance for Pinzón to arrive first in Spain. When Cristoforo finally got them moving, it was by sailing in the evening and hugging the coastline, where the breeze from shore counteracted the prevailing easterlies and carried them smoothly eastward. Even though the nights were clear, it was a dangerous business, sailing at night on an unfamiliar coastline, for no one knew what hazards there might be beneath the water. But Cristoforo could see no choice. It was either sail west and south around the island, which could be so huge that it would take months to circumnavigate it, or sail at night on the shore breezes. God would protect the ships, because if he didn't, the voyage would fail, or at least Cristoforo's part of it. What mattered now was getting back to Spain with glorious reports that concealed the disappointing amount of gold and the generally low level of civilization, so that their majesties would outfit a real fleet, and he could do some serious exploring until he found the lands Marco Polo had written of. What bothered Cristoforo most, however, was something that he could not explain even to himself. During the days as they lay at anchor and Cristoforo worked on charting the coast, he would sometimes turn away from the coast and look out over the open sea. It was then that he sometimes saw something out on the water. It would be visible only for a few moments at a time, and no one else reported seeing it at all. But Cristoforo knew that he had seen it, whatever it was, a patch of water that was slightly different in color from the water around it, and several times a shape like a man standing half in and half out of the water. The first time he saw the man-shape, he immediately remembered all the Genovese sailors' tales of mermen and other monsters of the deep. But whatever it was always far out to seaward, and came no closer. Was it some spiritual apparition, some sign from the Lord? Or was it a sign of the enmity of Satan, watching, waiting for some chance to disrupt this Christian expedition? Once, just once, Cristoforo caught a glimpse of light, as if whatever it was had a glass of its own and was watching him as steadily as he was watching it. Of this, Cristoforo wrote nothing in his log. Indeed, he tended to dismiss it as a sign of some slight madness brought about by tropical latitudes and the worries about Pinzón. Until disaster struck in the early hours of Christmas morning. Cristoforo was awake in his cabin. It was hard for him to sleep when the ship was sailing so dangerously close to land, and so he stayed awake most nights, studying his charts or writing in his log or his private diary. Tonight, though, he had done nothing more than lie on his bed, thinking about all that had happened in his life so far, marveling at how things had worked out despite all adversity, and finally praying, giving thanks to God for what had looked at the time like divine neglect, but now looked like miraculous shepherding. Forgive me for misunderstanding you, for expecting you to measure time by the short moments of a man's life. Forgive me for my fears and doubts along the way, for I see now that you are always at my side, watching over me and protecting me, and helping me to accomplish your will. A shudder ran through the boat, and from the deck came a scream.
Kemal watched through his night sights, hardly believing his good fortune. Why had he ever worried? Weather had been the cause of Columbus's delays in the prior history, and the same weather determined his progress now. Waiting for favorable winds had brought him to this spot, just past Cape Haitien on Christmas Eve, within 15 minutes of when he had arrived in Kemal's former past. The same currents and similar winds had caused the Santa Maria to drift onto a reef just as before. It was still possible for everything to work just right. Of course, it had always been the human factor, not the weather, that was expected to change. For all the talk of how a butterfly's wing in Beijing could cause a hurricane in the Caribbean, Manjam had explained to Kemal that pseudo-chaotic systems like weather were actually quite stable in their underlying patterns and swallowed up random, tiny fluctuations. The real problem was the decision-making of the men on the voyage. Would they do what they had done before? Kamal had watched the sinking of the Santa Maria 100 times or more, since so much depended on it. The ship sank because of several factors, any one of which might be changed on a whim. First, Columbus had to be sailing at night, and to Kamal's relief, he was consistently doing just that in order to fight the trade winds. Then both Columbus and Juan de la Cosa, the owner and master of the ship, had to be below decks, leaving the piloting of the ship in the hands of the Paralonso Niño, which was proper enough, since he was the pilot. But Niño then had to take a nap, leaving the helm in the hands of one of the ship's boys, giving him a star to steer by, which would be fine for an ocean voyage, but was hardly helpful when sailing along a treacherous and unfamiliar coast. In the event, the only difference was that it wasn't the same ship's boy. From his heightened manner, Kamal could tell, even at a distance, that this time it was Andres Yevanez, a bit older. But whatever experience Andres had would hardly help him now. No one had charted this coast, so even the most experienced pilot wouldn't have known that shells of coral would be so close to the surface without making any visible change in the sea. Even this had still been recoverable, even in the prior history, for Columbus immediately gave orders which, if they had been obeyed, would have saved the ship. What really sank the Santa Maria was its owner, Juan de la Cosa, who panicked and not only disobeyed Columbus's orders, but made it impossible for anyone else to obey him. From that point, the caravel had been doomed. Kamal, studying de la Cosa from the beginning of his life to the end, was unable to discover why he did such an inexplicable thing. De la Cosa never told the same story twice, and obviously lied every time. Kamal's only conclusion was that de la Cosa had panicked at the prospect of the ship sinking, and had simply got away as quickly and effectively as possible. By the time it became obvious that there was plenty of time to take all the men off without serious danger, it was far too late to save the ship. At that point, de la Cosa could hardly admit to cowardice, or whatever his motive was. The ship shuddered from the impact, then listed over to one side. Kamal watched anxiously. He was in full scuba gear, ready to come in close and put an explosive charge under the caravel in case it looked as though Columbus was about to save it. But it would be better if this ship could sink without inexplicable fires or explosions.
Juan de la Cosa stumbled out of his cabin and clambered up to the quarterdeck, not quite awake, but definitely inside a nightmare. His caravel had run aground. How could such a thing have happened? There was Colón, already on deck and angry. As always, Juan was filled with anger at the very sight of the Genovese courtier. If Pinzón had been in charge, there would have been no such nonsense as sailing at night. It was all Juan could do to get to sleep at night, knowing that his caravel was coasting a strange shore in darkness. And just as he had feared, they had run aground. They would all drown if they couldn't get off the ship before it sank. One of the ship's boys, Andres, the one that Niño fancied this week, was offering his pathetic excuses. "I kept my eye fixed on the star he pointed at and kept the mast lined up with it." He looked and sounded terrified. The ship lurched heavily to one side. "We will sink," thought Juan. "I will lose everything." "My caravel," he cried out. "My little ship, what have you done to it?" Colón turned to him with icy coldness. "Were you sleeping well?" he asked acidly. "Niño certainly was." "And shouldn't the ship's master be asleep? Juan wasn't the pilot, and he wasn't the navigator. He was just the owner. Hadn't it been made clear to him that he had almost no authority except as bestowed on him by Colón? As a Basque, Juan was as much a foreigner among these Spaniards as Colón himself, so that he got condescension from the Italian, contempt from the Spanish royal officers, and mockery from the Spanish sailors. But now, after having all control and respect stripped away, it was suddenly his fault that the ship ran aground. The ship listed further to port. Colón was speaking, but Juan had trouble concentrating on what he said.
The stern is heavy, and we're dragged onto an underwater reef or shelf. We'll make no headway forward. There's no choice for it but to warp the ship off.
This was the stupidest thing Juan had ever heard of. It was dark. The ship was sinking, and Cologne wanted to try some stupid maneuver instead of saving lives? That's what you'd expect of an Italian. What were Spanish lives to him? And when it came to that, what was a Basque life to the Spaniards? Cologne and the officers would get first call on the boats, but they wouldn't care what happened to Juan de la Cosa, while the men would never let him into a boat if they had a choice. He could see it, had always seen it in their eyes.
"Warp the ship off," said Cristoforo again. "Take the launch out, carry the anchor to sternward and drop it, and then use the windlass to draw us off the rock."
"I know what warping is," Juan answered. This fool, did he think he could teach seamanship to him?
"Then see to it, man," Cristoforo commanded, "or do you want to lose your caravel here in these waters?"
Well, let Cologne give his orders. He knew nothing. Juan de la Cosa was a better Christian than any of these men. The only way to get all the crew off was to bring the Nina's boat over to help. Forget drawing the anchor out. That would be slow and time-consuming, and men would die. Juan would save every life on this ship, and the men would know who cared for them. Not that braggart Pinzon who selfishly took off on his own. Certainly not Cologne, who thought only of the success of his expedition, never mind if men died in the doing of it. I'm the one, Juan de la Cosa, the Basque, the northerner, the outsider. I am the one who will help you live to return to your families in Spain.
Juan immediately set several men to lowering the launch. In the meantime, he heard Cologne barking orders to furl the sails and free the anchor.
Oh, what an excellent idea, thought Juan. The ship will sink with sails furled. That will make a huge difference to the sharks.
The launch dropped into the water with a splash. At once the launch's crew of three oarsmen scrambled down the lines and began untying the knots to free the launch from the caravel. In the meantime, Juan tried to climb down the rope ladder, which, with the ship tilting, dangled in midair and swayed dangerously. "Let me live to reach the launch, Holy Mother," he prayed, "and then I will be a hero to save the others." His feet found the boat, but he could not pry his fingers away from the rope ladder.
"Let go," demanded Peña, one of the seamen.
"I'm trying," thought Juan. "Why aren't my hands working?"
"He's such a coward," muttered Bartolomé.
"They pretend to speak softly," thought Juan, "but they always make sure I can hear them." His fingers opened. It had only been a moment. No one could be expected to act with perfect control when death by drowning lurked only moments away. He clambered over Peña to get to his place at the stern, controlling the tiller. "Row," he said. As they began pulling, Bartolomé, sitting in the bow, called the rhythm. He had once been a soldier in the Spanish army, but was arrested for stealing. He was one of those who joined the voyage as a criminal hoping for pardon. Most of the criminals were treated badly by the others, but Bartolomé's military experience had earned him some grudging respect from the others, and the slavish devotion of the other criminals. "Pull," he said, "pull." As they rowed, Juan turned the tiller hard to port.
"What are you doing?" demanded Bartolomé, when he saw that the launch was pulling away from the Santa Maria instead of heading for the bow, where the anchor was already beginning to descend.
"Do your job and I'll do mine," shouted Juan.
"We're supposed to lie under the anchor," answered Bartolomé.
"Do you trust your life to the Genovese? We're going to the Niña for help." The seaman's eyes widened. This was a direct contravention of orders. It bordered on mutiny against Cologne. They still didn't resume pulling on the oars.
"De la Cosa," said Peña, "aren't you going to try to save the caravel?"
"It's my ship," cried Juan, "and it's your lives. Pull on your oars and we can save everyone. Pull, pull."
Bartolomé took up the chant, and they pulled.
Only now did Cologne trouble to notice what they were doing. Juan could hear him crying out from the quarterdeck,
"Come back! What are you doing? Come and lie under the anchor!"
But Juan looked fiercely at the seaman. "If you want to live to see Spain again, then all we can hear is the splashing of the oars."
Wordlessly they rowed, hard and fast. The Niña grew larger in the distance, the Santa Maria smaller behind them.
"It's amazing which events turn out to have been inevitable," thought Gamal, "and which can be changed. The sailors all slept with different native women in Paradise Valley this time, so that apparently the choice of bedmates was entirely by random whim. But when it came to disobeying the only order that could have saved the Santa Maria, Juan de la Cosa apparently made the same choice no matter what. Love is random. Fear is inevitable. Too bad I'll never get a chance to publish this finding. I'm done with telling stories. I can only act out the end of my life. Who then will decide the meaning of my death? I will, as best I can. But then it will be out of my hands. They will make of me whatever they want, if they remember me at all. The world in which I discovered a great secret of the past and became famous no longer exists. Now I'm in a world where I was never born and have no past, a lone Muslim saboteur who somehow made his way to the new world. Who in the future will believe such a fantastic tale? Kamal imagined what the learned articles would sound like, explaining the psychosocial origin of the lone Muslim bomber legends from the voyage of Columbus. It brought a smile to his face as the crew of the Santa Maria rowed for the Niña.
Diko came back to Anquash with two full baskets of water hanging from the yoke over her shoulder. She had made the yoke herself, when it became clear to them all that no one in the village was as strong as Diko. It shamed the others to see her carry her water so easily when for them it was so hard. So she made the yoke so she could carry twice as much, and then she insisted on hauling the water alone, so that no one else could be compared to her. She made three trips a day to the stream under the falls. It kept her strong, and she appreciated the solitude. The others were waiting for her, of course. The water from her large baskets would be poured out into many smaller vessels, most of them clay pots. But she could see, even from a distance, that there was an eagerness to them. News, then. "The white man's canoe was taken by the spirits in the water," cried Putakam, as soon as Diko was close enough to hear. "On the very day you said." So now maybe Guacanagari will believe the warning and protect his young girls. Guacanagari was the cacique over most of northwestern Haiti. He fancied sometimes that his authority extended all the way up the mountains of Cibao to Anquash, though he had never attempted to test this theory in battle. There was nothing this high up in Cibao that he wanted. Guacanagari's dreams of being ruler of all of Haiti had led him in the prior history to make a fatal alliance with the Spanish. If they had not had him and his people to spy for them, and even fight beside them, the Spanish might not have prevailed. Other Taino leaders might have been able to unite Haiti in some kind of effective resistance, but that would not happen this time. Guacanagari's ambition would still be his guiding principle, but it would not have the same devastating effect. For Guacanagari would only be a friend to the Spanish when they seemed strong. As soon as they seemed weak, he would be their deadliest enemy. Diko knew enough not to trust his word even for a moment, but he was still useful, because he was predictable to one who understood his hunger for glory. Diko squatted down to take the yoke from her shoulders. Others held up the water baskets and began to pour them off into other vessels. "Guacanagari listened to a woman of Anquash," said Baiku skeptically. He was taking water into three pots. Little Inoxtala had cut himself badly in a fall, and Baiku was preparing a poultice, a tea, and a steam for him. One of the younger women immediately rushed to Diko's defense. "He must believe sees in the dark. All her words come true." As always, Diko denied her supposed prophetic gifts, though it had been her intimate knowledge of the future that kept her from living as a slave or the cacique's fifth wife. "It is Putakam who sees true visions, and Baiku who heals. I haul water." The others fell silent, for none of them had ever understood why Diko would say something which was so obviously false. Who ever heard of a person who refused to admit what she did well? Yet she was the strongest, tallest, wisest, and holiest person they had ever seen or heard of. And so, if she said this, then there must be some meaning in it, though it could not be taken at face value, of course. Think what you want, Deko said silently. But I know that the day has now come when I will have no more knowledge of the future than you have, because it will not be the future that I remembered. And what of the silent man, she asked. Oh, they say he is still in his boat made of water and air, watching. Another added, they say these white people can't see him at all. Are they blind? They don't know how to watch things, said Deko. They don't know how to see anything but what they expect to see. The Tainos down on the coast know how to see his boat made of water and air, because they saw him make it and put it into the water. They expect to see it. But the white men have never seen it before, so their eyes don't know how to find it. Still, they're very stupid not to see, said Gowalla, a teenage boy freshly into his manhood. You are very bold, said Deko. I'd be afraid to be your enemy. Gowalla preened. But I'd be even more afraid to be your friend in battle. You are sure your enemy is stupid because he doesn't do things as you would do them. It will make you careless, and your enemy will surprise you, and your friend will die. Gowalla went silent while the others laughed. You haven't seen the boat made of water and air, said Deko, so you don't know how hard or easy it is to see it. I want to see it, said Gowalla quietly. It will do you no good to see it, said Deko, because no one in the world has the power to make one like it, and no one will have such power for more than 400 years. Unless technology moved even faster in this new history. With luck, this time technology would not outstrip the ability of human beings to understand it, to control it, to clean up after it. You make no sense at all, said Gowalla. The others gasped. Only a man so young would speak so disrespectfully to seas in the dark. Gowalla is thinking, said Deko, that it is the thing that will only be seen once in 500 years that a man should go and see. But I tell you that it is only the thing that a man can learn from and use to help his tribe and his family that is worth going to see. The man who sees the boat made of water and air has a story that his children will not believe. But the man who learns how to make a great wooden canoe, like the ones the Spaniards sail in, can cross oceans with heavy cargo and many passengers. It is the Spaniards' canoes you want to see, not the boat made of water and air. I don't want to see the white men at all, said Putukam with a shudder. They are only men, said Deko. Some of them are very bad, and some of them are very good. All of them know how to do things that no one in Haiti knows how to do, and yet there are many things that every child in Haiti knows that these men do not understand at all. Tell us, several of them cried. I've told you all these stories about the coming of the white men, said Deko, and today there's work to do. They voiced their disappointment like children. And why shouldn't they? Such was the trust within the village, within the tribe, that no one was afraid to tell what he desired. The only feelings they had to hide from their fellow villagers were the truly shameful feelings, like fear and malice. Deko carried her yoke and her empty water baskets back to her house, a hut, really. Thankfully, no one was waiting for her there. She and Putukam were the only women to have houses of their own, and ever since the first time Deko had taken in a woman whose husband was angry at her and threatened to beat her, Putukam had joined her in making her house available as a refuge for women. There had been a great deal of tension at the beginning, since Nugkwi the cacique correctly saw Deko as a rival for power in the village. It only came to violence once, when 3 men came in the shadow of night armed with spears. It had taken her about 20 seconds to disarm all 3 of them, break the spear shafts, and send them staggering away with many cuts and bruises and sore muscles. They were simply no match for her size and strength, and her martial arts training. It wouldn't have kept them from trying something later, an arrow, a dart, a fire, except that Deko had taken action at first light. She gathered up her belongings and began giving them away as gifts to other women. This immediately aroused the whole village. "Where are you going?" they demanded. "Why are you leaving?" She had answered disingenuously, "I came to this village because I thought I heard a voice calling me here, but last night I had a vision of 3 men attacking me in the darkness, and I knew that the voice must have been wrong. It was not this village, because this village doesn't want me. I must go now and find the right village, the one that has a need for a tall, black woman to carry their water. After much remonstrance, she agreed to stay for 3 days. By the end of that time, I will go unless everybody in Ankuash has asked me, one at a time, to stay, and promise to make me their aunt, or their sister, or their niece. If even one person does not want me here, I will go. Nukkui was no fool. Much as he might resent her authority, he knew that having her in the village gave Ankuash enormous prestige among the Taino who lived farther down the mountain. Didn't they send their sick to Ankuash now to be healed? Didn't they send messengers to ask the meanings of events or to learn what seas in the dark predicted for the future? Until Diko came, the people of Ankuash were despised as the people who lived in the cold place on the mountain. It was Diko who had explained that their tribe was the first to live on Haiti, that their ancestors were the first to be brave enough to sail from island to island. For a long time, the Taino have had their way here, and the Caribs want to do the same to them, she explained. But the time is soon coming when Ankuash will once again lead all the people of Haiti, for this is the village that will tame the white men. Nukkui was not about to let this exalted future slip away. I want you to stay, he had said, gruffly. I'm glad to hear that. Have you seen Baiku about that nasty bruise on your forehead? You must have bumped into a tree when you went out to pee in the dark. He glared at her. Some say you do things a woman shouldn't do. But if I do them, then they must be things that I believe a woman should do. Some say that you are teaching their wives to be rebellious and lazy. I never teach anyone to be lazy. I work harder than anybody, and the best women of Ankuash follow my example. They work hard, but they don't always do what their husbands tell them. But they do almost everything that their husbands ask them to do, said Diko, especially when their husbands do everything the women ask them to do. Nukkui had sat there for a long while, sucking on his anger. That cut on your arm looks ugly, said Diko. Was somebody careless with his spear point on yesterday's hunt? You change everything, said Nukkui. Here was the crux of the negotiation. Nukkui, you are a brave and wise leader. I watched you for a long time before I came here. Wherever I went, I knew that I would make changes, because the village that teaches the white men how to be human has to be different from all other villages. There will be a dangerous time when the white men are not yet tamed, when you may need to lead our men in war, and even in peace, you are the cacique. When people come to me for judgment, don't I always send them to you? Don't I always show you respect? Grudgingly, he admitted that she did. I have seen a terrible future, in which the white men come, thousands upon thousands of them, and make our people into slaves, the ones they don't kill outright. I have seen a future in which on the whole island of Haiti there is not one Taino, not one Carib, not one man or woman or child of Ankuash. I came here to prevent that terrible future, but I can't do it alone. It depends on you as much as on me. I don't want you to obey me. I don't want to rule over you. What village would respect Ankuash if the cacique took orders from a woman? But what cacique deserves respect if he can't learn wisdom just because a woman teaches it to him? He watched her impassively, and then said, "Seas in the dark is a woman who tames men." The men of Ankuash are not animals. Seas in the dark came here because the men of Ankuash have already tamed themselves. When women took refuge in my tent, or putakams, the men of this village could have torn apart the walls and beaten their wives or killed them, or putakam, or even me, because I may be clever and strong, but I am not immortal, and I can be killed. Nukkui blinked at that statement. But the men of Ankuash are truly human. They were angry with their wives, but they respected the door of my house and the door of putakam's house. They stayed outside and waited until their anger had cooled. Then their wives came out, and no one was beaten, and things were better. They say that Pudukkam and I were making trouble, but you are the cacique. You know that we were helping make peace. But it only worked because the men and women of this village wanted peace. It only worked because you, as cacique, allowed it to work. If you saw another cacique act as you have acted, wouldn't you call him wise?
Yes, said Nukkui. I also call you wise, said Diko, but I won't stay unless I can also call you my uncle. He shook his head. That wouldn't be right. I'm no uncle to you, Seas in the Dark. No one would believe it. They would know that you are only pretending to be my niece.
Then I can't stay, she said, rising to her feet.
Sit down, he said. I can't be your uncle, and I won't be your nephew. But I can be your brother.
Diko had fallen to her knees before him then, and embraced him where he sat on the ground. Oh, Nukkui, you are the man I hoped for.
You are my sister, he said again, but I thank every Pasuk that lives in these woods that you are not my wife.
With that, he got up and left her house. From then on, they were allies. Once Nukkui's word was given, he didn't break it or allow any of the angry men to break it either. The result was inevitable. The men learned that rather than have the public humiliation of their wives taking refuge in the house of Diko or Pudukkam, they would control their anger, and no woman had been beaten in Ankuash for more than a year. Now women were more likely to come to Diko's house to complain about a husband who had lost his desire for her, or to ask her for magic or prophecy. She gave them neither, but instead offered sympathy and common-sense advice. Alone in her house, she took up the calendar she was keeping and reviewed in her mind the events that would come in the next few days. Down on the coast, the Spanish would be turning to Guacanagari for help. In the meantime, Kamal, the one the Indies called Silent Man, would be destroying the other Spanish ships. If he failed, or if the Spanish succeeded in building new ships and sailed for home, then her work would be to unify the Indies to prepare them to beat off the Spanish. But if the Spanish were stranded here, then her work would be to spread stories that would lead Columbus to her. As social order broke down in the expedition, a near certainty once they were stranded, Columbus would come to need a refuge. That would be Ankuash, and it would be her job to get him and any who came with him under control. If she had had to do a number on the Indies to get them to accept her, wait till they saw what she did to the white man. Ah, Kamal. She had prepared the ground for him by saying that a person of power might come, a silent man, who would do marvelous things but would keep to himself. Leave him alone, she said in all her telling of this tale. All this time, she had no idea whether he would come or not. For all she knew, she had been the only one to succeed in reaching her destination. It was such a relief when word reached her that the silent man was living in the forest near the seashore. For several days she toyed with the idea of going to see him. He had to be even lonelier than she was, disconnected from her own time, from all the people she had loved. But it wouldn't do. When he succeeded in his work, he would be perceived by the Spanish as their enemy. She could not be linked with him, even in Indy legend, for soon enough all those stories would reach Spanish ears. So she let it be known that she wanted to know all about his movements, and that she thought it would be wise to leave him alone. Her authority wasn't all-pervasive, but Seas in the Dark was regarded with enough awe, even by far-off villagers who had never spoken with her, that her advice concerning this strange, bearded man was taken seriously. Someone clapped outside her house. "Be welcome," she said. The woven reed flap was lifted aside, and Chipa came in. She was a young girl, perhaps 10 years old, but smart, and Diko had chosen her to be her messenger to Cristoforo. "Estás lista?" Diko asked her.
"Lista, mas estoy con miedo."
"I'm ready, but I'm afraid." Chipa's Spanish was solid. Diko had taught her for 2 years now. The two of them never spoke any other language between each other anymore, and of course Chipo was already fluent in the Taino language that was the lingua franca on Haiti, even though the villagers of Ancouache usually spoke a different and much older language among each other, especially on solemn or sacred occasions. Language came easily to Chipa. She would do well as an interpreter. Interpretation was the one